All right. Well, thank you again for your patience. I think we'll go ahead and get started, and people will be joining. And as I said a little bit earlier, the call is being recorded, and we're going to be posting this on the website so people can access it in the future for those who aren't able to join to the other conflicts. But I'm delighted to welcome you all to the next in our series of post-CROI webinars, and particularly delighted to welcome John Mascola to present. I'll just give a little bit of background and then turn it over to John to take us through a presentation, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers and discussion. Throughout John's presentation, you are welcome, if you're on the ReadyTalk interface, to put in questions there, and we'll put them in the queue. You can also email any of them to avac@avac.org, and then at the very end, I'll put up a slide, and you'll see how to unmute yourself, and we can take questions, and I'll go through those details again when we get to that point in the call. You know, CROI is a remarkable conference in many respects that took place back in February and takes place each year. And in addition to a range of abstract-driven sessions and special symposia on critical issues, each day starts with a couple of plenary talks. And the very first morning of CROI actually began with John Mascola's plenary talk, looking at the issues of antibodies for both prevention and treatment. And this is an area that has taken on a great deal of interest in the field over the last several years, due in no small part to John and his colleagues at the Vaccine Research Center, which is part of the U.S. National Institutes of Health. I will say, because it's getting almost that time of year, as many of you will know, in May, we will all look to commemorate HIV Vaccine Awareness Day. And while that day is used for lots of different reasons, I think for a lot of us working in HIV vaccine advocacy, May 18th is a great reminder of then-President Clinton calling for a new commitment to accelerate the development of an AIDS vaccine. And one of the very specific outcomes of that presentation in May 1997, almost 19 years ago, was the establishment of the Vaccine Research Center. So over, 19 years since it was announced or birthed by the administration, scientists have populated that center and really been leading the field in so many ways. And I'm delighted that John is here. John now directs that Vaccine Research Center, which, although very much focused on HIV vaccines and will be the focus, obviously, of today's talk, is working on a number of other vaccine concepts. And you may all have seen news over the last year or so of some of their leadership, not only in HIV vaccine research, but in Ebola vaccine development as well. So the Vaccine Research Center has really become a pivotal organization within the vaccine community. John has been there since 2000 and has directed the center for the last several years and has really been just a great colleague and a great scientist for those advocates of us who strive to understand many of the complexities of the work that he and his colleagues engage with. As I said, at CROI, he did a plenary talk looking at harnessing antibodies for HIV prevention and treatment, and I think that we'll talk a bit more about that in the conversation in terms of the exciting opportunities in both preventing and treating and not one or the other. But without further ado, I'll turn it over to you, John, and again, if you have questions as we go, feel free to put them in the chat feature or avac@avac.org.
Well, thank you very much, Mitchell, and thank you, and thanks to AVAC for the invitation to talk to all of you who are on the web, so good morning, good afternoon. As Mitchell said, this is a version of a talk that I gave at the CROI meeting. It was a title that the organizer of the meeting asked me to talk about because I think they felt that a review of where the field is regarding antibodies and HIV prevention and treatment was timely because there was a lot of progress in the field. So with that, let me begin the talk and tell you, by moving to the next slide here, what the talk will encompass. So I'll break the talk down into three parts. One will be a little bit of background, just so you have a sense of what antibodies we're talking about, where they came from. And then very specifically, I'll address the question, can antibodies be used to prevent HIV infection, and do antibodies have a role in the treatment of HIV infection? So it's important in the field of infectious diseases, I think, to have a little bit of perspective. And those of us who are infectious disease docs know some of the history, which is that if we go way back to the pre-antibiotic era, there was something called serum therapy, which is a way to treat many infectious diseases using immune serum from one person to another. And actually, the Nobel Prize in Medicine and Physiology was awarded in the pre-antibiotic era for the use of serum therapy for diseases such as diphtheria, tetanus, and streptococcus. And then going forward in time a little bit, on the next slide, is some perspective on how antibodies were used for viral infections. And now going back to before there were very many effective vaccines, we used, or the field used, purified antibodies for measles and polio and hepatitis A and numerous other diseases. And then importantly, we still use them. So on the bottom of this slide, for example, we use antibodies such as hepatitis B immune globulin, and we use an antibody against respiratory syncytial virus in red here, mainly to protect infants in the early days from infection. So all of this history gives us some background to tell us that the concept of using antibodies against HIV really follows pretty naturally from a long history in infectious diseases. So the question is, what's changed recently to really highlight or bring antibody to the forefront of our attention? And what really has occurred is that since about 2009, the field has discovered a whole set of quite potent and what we call broadly reactive antibodies to HIV, and they're shown on this slide where I think most of you recognize the HIV envelope like a protein that we call a trimer, and all of these antibodies that are shown here are various antibodies discovered in the laboratory in the last few years that bind to different sites on the virus. And I think that if we can make it work, we may or may not be able to. I have a slide here showing how the antibodies would bind to HIV, and it may not work on the web. So let me go back one and just show you that the different sites on the envelope are the CD4 binding site. There are antibodies that bind on the outside of the envelope here, and sometimes they bind sugar molecules or glycan molecules. Sometimes they bind deep inside the virus. Sometimes they bind very close to the viral membrane. So antibodies really cover the entire surface of the envelope of the HIV virus. So then what we need to do is, if we're going to use these antibodies clinically, is understand two key characteristics. One is the antibody potency, and the other is the breadth of reactivity, which is how many viruses the antibody can actually recognize. And so we depict those on a pretty simple graph. Potency goes in this sort of opposite direction because lower values mean the antibody is more potent, it's active at a lower value. And then the breadth is how many viruses are covered. And so I put all these antibodies that are now in the laboratory on this scale, and in the star would be a perfect antibody. A perfect antibody would have 100% covered against all strains of HIV, which we know is not so easy, and would be very, very potent. And what we can see is that a lot of antibodies are very broad, some antibodies are very potent, and by understanding these characteristics, we can combine the right antibodies to cover the sort of the wide range of HIV strains that we know exist throughout the world. And I'll make one other background point, which is that what we're going to talk about in the next few minutes are using antibodies as a protein and giving them as an agent. But many scientists, myself included, have studied antibodies from the perspective of teaching us about HIV vaccines. And that's what's shown in this slide. Antibodies give us structures so we know how they actually bind to the virus. We know what virus epitopes look like. Scientists have figured out in recent years what the actual HIV envelope-like protein looks like structurally, shown here with all the sugar molecules on it. And so all of that's very important and will help us design and develop a vaccine, but that is going to take realistically some years to really move forward. Whereas antibodies are now available as clinical products essentially now. So we can learn a lot about using antibodies in the very near future. So the first question that comes up is, can antibodies be used to prevent infections, for example, as a means of pre-exposure prophylaxis? So there is a long history of what we call preclinical data, data not in humans but in animal models, that give us an answer to this question. And what we think we've learned from more than 20 years of animal studies is that the answer looks like a likely yes. Antibodies can very effectively prevent, for example, what we call a SHIV infection in the monkey model, a simian human virus that we use to use the monkey model. So that's all very encouraging data, but the important sort of caveat to all that are there are actually no human data yet to tell us that antibodies can actually protect, and these are the data that we'd like to develop. So this is the same slide, but now showing you which of these many antibodies that are in the laboratory are actually in the clinic. It does take a while to move from the laboratory in the clinic, but I'd emphasize that progress has been quite rapid. So there are two antibodies shown in red that have been in early human trials and actually published. And that's pretty remarkable progress given that the first description of these antibodies was only about 5 or 6 years ago in the lab. To actually be in the clinic and getting phase one data is pretty rapid progress. And then there are quite a few antibodies that are coming along. In blue are antibodies that are likely to be tested in people in the next year, and in green are antibodies that are being developed for clinical application. So in the next few years, we'll have antibodies not just to one region of the virus, but to several regions of the virus. So I'm going to show you a little bit of data on one of these antibodies that's called VRC01. The antibody binds to the CD4 binding site, so that's where the viral envelope engages CD4. So clearly, if an antibody can block that interaction, it can block viral infection. And antibodies to the CD4 binding site tend to be generally pretty broadly reactive because this site is conserved, and that's what this, we call this a dendrogram because it shows all the dendrites of different strains of viruses from different clades. And if we've colored it in red, that particular virus is strongly neutralized by the antibody. So it doesn't get every virus, but it gets the large majority of virus. So going back one step before humans, we always do some kind of preclinical data. Data in the monkey model give us an idea of how much antibody. So we can actually, the way these studies are done are the antibody is infused first, and then one waits for some period of time, and the animals are challenged with the virus, and we look to see if those animals are actually protected. And what we can see is, we see very good protection if we infuse a higher dose of antibody. And what one has to learn is how low can we go, what dose of antibody actually protects. And one can see that as we go low enough, the antibody protection begins to go away or break through. And then we can ask the question, what level of antibody is in the serum is associated with protection? These are key data to tell us about how to design human studies. And if we graphically represent that here on this sort of dot plot graph, one can see a whole lot of different strains of HIV. And what we depict is the sensitivity of all the HIV strains to this particular antibody called VRC01. And then superimposed on that, we put the SHIVs that we use in animal model. So some SHIVs, as I show here, are more resistant. Some SHIVs are generally more sensitive. And we need to look at the spectrum in the animal model so we can try to get a sense of the real world of HIV diversity, because that's what we're likely to encounter if we do human clinical studies. So we can get numbers about how much antibody should be in the serum to get protection. Again, these are animal model studies, but they give us an idea. So numbers like 20 micrograms per mil in the serum if we want to be able to protect against the more resistant type strain. So now we can actually go to a human clinical study. So the first in human studies are always phase one, smaller studies. We look for safety primarily, but we expect and now know that antibodies are very safe when we infuse them because these are human antibodies, and there's a long history of using antibodies as agents in people. But importantly, what you can see in this study is the level of antibody in the serum. So there's one administration of the antibody. That's important. In this case, it was given intravenously, but the goal is to give it as a subcutaneous injection, as I'll show you. And one can see that there's this very high level, and there's this slow sort of tail of the antibody level over 2 months. And what these types of studies showed us is that we think that antibodies should be in a range that we think are physiological range, a range that might be protective, for 1 or even 2 months. So, of course, again, we're estimating based on animal data, but we think we have a reasonable sense of what levels should be effective. This gives us a sense of how to design a human clinical trial. So what do we need to think about for a human clinical trial? Again, we're talking about an antibody that could protect someone from exposure and infection with HIV. And so the clinical questions are straightforward. Can antibodies do that? Can they prevent infection? And what level of antibody is needed to protect? And then there are a lot of important scientific questions. Where does the antibody work specifically? At what mucosal surface? How much is needed? What kind of antibody functions are actually associated with protection? So one can learn a lot, the field can learn a lot. Not just does this work, but how does it work? That informs future studies. So I'm showing you in a depiction here that antibodies are aimed at blocking here this initial infection event so that viremia never gets established in a person. So So there has been a lot of discussion with many outstanding groups who do clinical studies about the design of a study called an antibody-mediated prevention study. It would be what's called a phase 2B study, meaning it's the aim of the study is to ask whether the product, the experimental product, actually works. And the question at hand is, can a passively infused monoclonal antibody prevent HIV infection in high-risk adults? This study will initiate in the next weeks or month by these networks that I think many of you know, the Prevention Trials Network and the HIV Vaccine Trials Network, which are very well-established, very experienced networks running trials for pre-exposure prophylactic-type studies or vaccines, for example. The trial has evolved slightly in the details of its design, but it will involve two high-risk cohorts, one mainly in the Americas, mainly high-risk men, one mainly in the region of sub-Saharan Africa, mainly in high-risk women. And the study is very carefully designed to have a certain ability to detect efficacy. So these are statistical numbers, but the power to detect some efficacy at all is very high, over 90%. And this trial, again, is anticipated actually to open for enrollment very soon. So when we do an experimental study, we always have to think about why are we doing it and what happens if we see some success. How is it going to inform the field? How are we going to move forward to something that might actually be useful? So if the study gives us an expected level of success or a level of success that we think is important, this will help us define the level of antibody that's needed in the serum to actually protect. That's a key number. I showed you that number in monkeys and in animals, but we need to know that level in humans. What does that translate to? Well, if the level is reasonably achievable, like a number of 10 micrograms per mil in the serum, then we can give antibodies by subcutaneous administration, which is what we need to do, not intravenous. This will give us actually an incentive to develop next-generation antibodies that are even more potent. So if the first antibody works at this level and we can make an antibody tenfold more potent, that antibody will work at one or lower micrograms per mil. So now we have the ability to use even lower amounts of antibody product, and that really improves the feasibility of moving such antibodies through the clinical development pipeline. So I borrowed a slide, a very nice slide, from the AVAC website to remind us all that there are a lot of types of tools that are potentially available to help prevent HIV infection. So it's always a reasonable question to ask, why should we study another one? We have things at hand that might work. And the answer to that question I propose on the next slide is that what we're talking about here is still an experimental agent, but it's an agent with a reasonable likelihood to work. It's an agent that is likely to be very safe and well-tolerated because they're human antibodies. And what are the potential advantages? These are potential advantages, need to be verified in clinical studies, but they are that this agent, an antibody, could be used as a single shot, a single administration, and that it could confer a long-lasting protection on the order of months. And that if we show this to be the case in a clinical trial, that provides major incentive to develop an antibody product that could even be somewhat better, somewhat longer lasting, and I'll show you that in a moment, so that the overall goal is a subcutaneous injectable antibody product given on the order of once every 3 to 4 months that safely and effectively protects against HIV infection. So how do we get there? So we need to have a goal in mind, a profile of an agent. So that would be we want to cover essentially all viral strains for HIV, which is not so easy, but I think doable. We want to be very potent, even more potent than this first experimental antibody we're testing. That gets us into more cost-effective and manufacturable ranges. We need to be able to give something subcutaneously, which is really quite achievable to do a quick subcutaneous injection. It's done all the time, and it needs to last for a long time. And then the cost needs to be reasonable, but the cost is really driven by these other factors. Something that can be given at a lower dose and last for a long time actually becomes quite cost-effective. This is a typical graph. We use these as laboratory data, but we can compare a whole lot of antibodies. So all these antibodies are in the laboratory. Some of them, as I said, are moving to the clinic. More potent is down in this direction. And what you can see is, and these are all different virus strains, because for HIV we need to consider all this diversity. So what you can see is that here's the antibody VRC01, and this is what we consider to be pretty potent. It covers and neutralizes these viruses at a level of about 1 microgram per mil. But you can see in the laboratory we have antibodies that are already tenfold more potent. And we have antibodies to other sites that are highly potent. And we have some antibodies coming along that are both very potent and broad. So there's a lot of optimism at the laboratory discovery level. And if we develop clinical data that antibodies could work, that really does provide the rationale for moving these forward to clinical development. The other type of data we can generate is ask, what happens if we combine antibodies together? Again, these are still in vitro data, but we can ask what fraction of all these HIV strains that we test are neutralized, and we want to get this graph up to 100%. And you can see that with single antibodies in colors, we can get up there, but with two antibodies, we really get close to 100%. So the thinking is that the product we want to develop would be a combination of two antibodies, or we actually may have other ways of get there, products we call bispecific antibodies, and I'll mention those in just a moment. So what about making antibodies last a long time? This is a somewhat technical slide, but it tells you that we can mutate the antibody in very well-established ways, ways that are published and already tested, and what that does is helps the antibody linger and last much longer in the serum. That's what these slides show. It shows you the specific mutations. And I refer to a very nice study published where an antibody that has a long name here, Motivizumab, and this is just a phase one study looking at these mutations. You can see the regular antibody that's given here, it has a decay curve compared to the mutated antibody, which has these what we call half-life extension mutations. And what's fascinating here is that the antibody can actually last in the serum for many months at a level that may be effective. So this is a key characteristic of antibodies compared potentially to other agents, which is the potential to be effective with a single administration for several months at a time. So this is just to tell you that the antibody VRC01 that I've mentioned to you about, we've made these mutations into the antibody. So each time one wants to study a clinical product, of course, there's a long process of going from the laboratory discovery to a clinical grade material to a phase one study. But we have now started a phase one study with these mutations so that we'll have data very soon to say that we can take HIV antibodies and potentially extend their half-life in humans to a longer periods of time, longer than 1 to 2 months. So one other point about prevention before we move on, which is that there's a long history for antibodies, of use of antibodies for protecting babies against infants, against certain infectious diseases, such as hepatitis B infection or, for example, respiratory syncytial virus infection. And so this gives us some sense of the potential for antibody use, for example, to protect babies during a course of breastfeeding. And there are a large body of data and some very recent data, again, in animal models, that give us some sense that this actually could be the case in humans. This is one study that will be published very soon by Nancy Hagwood and colleagues at the Oregon Primate Center. And I'll just describe what it shows rather than going into a lot of detail, which is that even if the antibodies are given a day after the infant is exposed to HIV, those infants are completely protected. So that really gives a sense of the potential power of antibodies to protect babies who might be born in a situation where the mother wasn't able to take effective antiretroviral therapy and be fully suppressed. So I'll summarize the prevention part of the talk by saying, just reminding you that we have a long history of animal model data, but what the field needs to really understand if antibodies could play a role in humans are proof of concept data in humans, and that this will really provide the incentive to move products forward. And importantly, with foreseeable engineering, the potency of antibodies, the potency and the half-life of antibodies could really be improved to the point where they could play a major role in prevention of HIV infection. So then the other major area that the field has been thinking about is treatment of infection. And this is a very different area. Antibodies certainly have been used for treatment, but the considerations are quite different. And why is that? So in prevention, as this sort of graphic shows, you're trying to block a single event, a person where there's an exposure, there's some virus in the mucosal surface, and the antibody prevents that event and therefore prevents infection. When someone is infected, there's a lot more going on. So what are we thinking in the field? We're thinking that antibodies potentially could be complementary to very well-established antiretroviral treatment. Why is that? Antibodies work differently, and importantly, they have the potential to eliminate infected cells. and therefore the potential to impact the reservoir. This is because if one looks at the schematic here, antiretroviral drugs work by preventing the viral life cycle so that the virus can never bud from the cell. The difference is that antibodies actually have the potential to kill a cell that's infected. And that's shown over here, where if there's an infected cell, antibodies can then bring in natural killer cells that would potentially kill an infected cell. It's important to say that this is all in vitro type data. We understand this is how antibodies work. This is how antibodies could work. This is what antibodies do in the laboratory. And then the question is, could antibodies do this in the context of a real clinical study? So how might antibodies be used in the context of HIV infection? So there are a number of considerations. This is not complete, but I'll list just three of them here. So in the cases, and they're not all that common, where HIV infection is diagnosed very early, and we want to try to treat that person very early and limit the seeding of the viral reservoir, antibodies could be added to antiretroviral drug to very rapidly decrease the virus load in the person and therefore limit the seeding of the viral reservoir. Another different way to consider antibodies is to maintain long-term viral suppression. So there are now, of course, many and most people in the country, in the United States, are very well suppressed on antiretroviral drugs. And then the issue is how to maintain that suppression with the easiest antiretroviral drug regimen. There's thinking that one could use long-acting antiretroviral drugs that could be given, for example, once every few months by injection, eliminate the need for an oral pill. Since antibodies potentially can also be given once every 2 or 3 months, there's interest in studying the possibility of adding antibodies to long-acting antiretroviral drugs, as here. And then there's this question of actually impacting the viral reservoir. And that's making use of what I just mentioned, these effector functions of antibodies, where if antibodies are infused in the right way, in the right setting, could they actually kill cells, decrease the reservoir, and actually improve an person's ability to remain symptom-free. So with regard to clinical use of antibodies for treatment, there's opportunities and there's limitations, and I think it's always important to understand those so that one takes the right considerations in moving forward clinically. The opportunities are that antibodies have very distinct mechanisms for current drugs. They block entry rather than block the life cycle. They have the potential to marshal or harness the immune system to kill cells. The antibodies are safe and well-tolerated generally, and they have a potential for a long therapeutic effect. What are the current limitations? So unlike an antiretroviral drug like Truvada, antibodies are still at the test phase. They are unlicensed biologics, so they're not immediately available. We have to establish clinical proof of concept in order to bring them forward. There's some level of intrinsic resistance. So antibodies aren't effective against 100% of viruses, at least not as a single agent. What this suggests is that we're going to need 2 or 3 antibodies at a time, which is not unlike what happened over time with antiretroviral drugs. Antibodies are not oral agents. They'd be subcutaneous agents. And right now we have very limited clinical data, but that's what we're trying to achieve. That's what we're trying to address, is to establish the clinical data needed to move these products forward. That clinical data exists in a couple of published studies, and I'll review them very quickly. One published by a very good group at Rockefeller University, showing in this right panel here, sort of the log drop, so this is a 10-fold drop in viremia, by a single administration of an antibody called 3BC117, which targets a site on the CD4 binding site. This was proof of concept that there's a biologic effect, that in a human, the antibody does what you'd expect it to do, which is block viral entry and drop viral load for a period of time while the antibody is still present in the serum. And then similar data with the antibody VRC01, just to show you some more detail. These are the actual viral loads in 8 individuals who volunteered for a study. They had some level of baseline viremia that you can see here, and you can see the drop in the viremia with a single administration of antibody. If the viral load in these people were starting out to be low, you can see the antibody drops the viral load to undetectable because there's not so much virus in the system and the antibody has an easier job. When there's a lot of virus in the system, the single antibody drops the viral load, but the viral load comes back. That's because this antibody wasn't able to drop the viral load completely, for example, like triple drug therapy, and in that setting, the virus starts to select out resistant strains. So this teaches us a lot about how to use antibodies in the setting of those who are HIV infected or viremic. These show the data another way, that some individuals have this very long sustained suppression, some individuals have a shorter level of suppression. A couple individuals don't respond to the antibody very well at all, and what we learn is that's because their virus was resistant even before they received antibody, which occurs in about 10% of people. So this graph just shows that the individuals who didn't respond to the antibody have these very high values, meaning that the virus required very high levels of the antibody to be suppressed in vitro, and this then is associated with the lack of clinical effect. So again, this teaches us how to use antibodies. Not everyone is going to respond. We'll probably need more than one antibody to cover viruses like this that are resistant to this antibody. We would need to use a combination antibody. So we learn a lot from these small phase one studies. What we know from monkey studies, again, stepping back to what we call preclinical, is that indeed if you do combine antibodies, so these are studies, I'm giving you two citations of two groups who have studied in animal studies, combinations of antibodies work better than a single antibody, which is as we'd expect, but this gives us in vivo proof that you get these very nice suppressions of viral load with antibody combinations. So again, the preclinical data really do inform the clinical studies, and the two are synergistic with each other in how to potentially advance the product. So then just to sort of finish up, it's always useful to think of what's possible in the laboratory and what could move forward clinically. There are newly designed variations of human antibodies. For example, we call these bispecific T-cell engagers or dual affinity targeting proteins. These designs take advantage of the fact that one arm of an antibody could bind to an infected cell. The other arm of the antibody could bring in some kind of a killer immune cell in close proximity. So now the antibody doesn't have to work by itself to kill an infected cell. You're actually harnessing the immune system. These types of agents have already been designed and used for certain types of cancers where you try to bring in a killer cell or immune cell in close proximity to a cancer cell. So there's proof of concept in the arena of cancer, and so there's the potential to think about similar agents for doing the same thing for HIV infection. So this slide just highlights that there's a lot of excitement in the field, publications by very good groups on designing these bispecific antibodies. All of these data are laboratory data. The antibodies work just as I showed you in that diagram, very nicely to kill infected cells in the laboratory, in tissue culture, and really the next step is to move them forward in the clinic. But this is the type of science that we need to do and understand in order to think about how to really move the field forward in a very qualitative way. So the lessons from the phase one trial so far are that HIV antibodies are biologically active. They can reduce plasma viremia. However, we learned important things, that selection for resistant strains can occur pretty rapidly if we have incomplete viral suppression. Therefore, combinations of antibodies or even antibodies and antiretroviral drugs are likely to be required, and that if we actually want to impact the viral reservoir, which is a major goal of the field, this will likely require longer-term administration of antibodies, potentially with agents that we call latency-reversing agents, which allow cells to express the virus. And these types of studies need to be designed and tested. These are pretty longer clinical trials where one needs to combine antibodies with different types of agents, and then do very careful measures of viral reservoir. Such studies are now just being initiated and will be conducted over the next year or two. So as an overall summary for the talk, there has been rapid advancement of HIV antibodies in clinical trials since they were first discovered in 2009. Even though there are, you know, now 5 or 6 years have gone by, for laboratory discovery all the way to making a clinical product, to real clinical data that teaches us something, that's pretty remarkable progress. And I think the key here is to continue that clinical progress and learn even more in the next couple of years. Antibodies are classically used to prevent infections, as I told you, for many, many years. So there is a phase 2B study of an antibody for prevention that will begin in the next few months. It will take a year or two to completely conduct that study, but we think we'll learn a tremendous amount about the potential for antibodies in that setting. With regard to treatment, we think that antibodies could contribute to long-term viral suppression, could contribute to targeting and killing infected cells, as I've just described, and those will require careful clinical studies. Improved antibodies continue to be discovered and engineered. There's tremendous potential in this field, and that potential really is only realized by continuing the science and in parallel continuing the clinical studies. So clinical data are needed to stimulate further development of antibodies for prevention and treatment of infection. And I will end the talk there with an acknowledgement slide that is really never enough to thank and acknowledge many people who are involved, not just at VRC or at NIH, but in many institutions who contribute to the science, who contribute to clinical development, who contribute to preclinical data. So thank you all for your attention. I'll turn it back over to Mitchell.
Great. John, thank you so much. That was a fabulous overview across the landscape, and a lot of questions have come in both on the chat feature as well as a bunch have come in via email. Some are quite general about antibodies, and then some are more specific about some of the products you described. So I might take a little time to go through some of both types of questions. Feel free, those on the call, to continue to share those on the ReadyTalk or via email. And then in a few minutes, perhaps I'll open up the line to see what other questions might come. But that was terrific. I think one of the questions that came in toward the very beginning via email, you described this really exciting series of new discoveries over the last several years of these antibodies. And a very basic question, where are these antibodies coming from? And even in your last slide, you talked about the need to the discoveries of additional antibodies. So where are you and colleagues finding these antibodies?
Yes, great question. They come from very important volunteers, HIV-infected individuals, who first donate their serum. If their serum shows very high antibody neutralization activity, which is a laboratory test, they come back, they donate their blood again, and from their B cells, which make antibodies, we have the technology to isolate the antibody. So these antibodies come from volunteer HIV-infected individuals.
Great, and I think a follow-on question to that, which I know comes up a lot in these discussions. So if they're coming, if these antibodies might prevent and might provide some degree of therapeutic benefit as new interventions, why didn't they have any benefit for the people who participated and provided the samples that where you discovered the antibodies?
Yes, so the intriguing part of HIV infection is that there's this interplay and sort of fight between the virus and the immune system over a long period of time such that the virus stays one step ahead of both the T cells and the antibody response in individuals. So in a sense, if there weren't T cells and antibodies in HIV infection, people would actually succumb very quickly. So the T cells and antibodies do something, they keep people around, but eventually the virus mutates and wins out. So what we think with regard to antibodies, the key is to use them early, right? Either to prevent, where there's no virus yet, and they can prevent infection, or to use them in the right way, in the right combination with drugs, so one actually turns the tide back in favor of the immune system, rather than what happens in the natural course of infection.
Great. You know, a number of the slides that you mentioned and investigators at the VRC and many of the other academic settings like Rockefeller raise a question for a lot of advocates that I a couple of emails about who else is involved, particularly from industry. Obviously, for a lot of us working on vaccine and microbicide advocacy, we've always wanted more industry involvement. Is there an industry connection with antibodies, both in terms of the discovery and then in the future, perhaps around manufacturing these?
Yes, this is very important. And generally, there's an enormous recent investment by industry in antibodies. For other diseases other than HIV, because we know they work well. They work very well for treatment of some cancers. They work very well for prevention of respiratory syncytial virus, for example. So the goal here is to sort of facilitate or engender some interest of industry in HIV antibodies. We think the way to do that, and the role of NIH and research is to establish some scientific proof of concept that antibodies could and should actually have a role clinically. And this helps, I think, engender interest. So I think we have seen and heard of a lot of industry interest, and there is potential for engaging them for manufacturing. What I think they need to see is a little bit more clinical data. Those are exactly the type of data, for example, that the AMP study would generate, that an antibody could work, or that these ACTG or other clinical studies will generate, that an antibody may impact the viral reservoir. I think that'll help get us there.
Great. A question came in. Very early on, you mentioned some of the history of the use of antibodies, both pre-vaccine period, but also even post. How are some of those administered? Because you talked about a number of HIV, both preventive and therapeutic antibody, that could be potentially infused or subcutaneously delivered. How are other antibodies for other diseases being administered?
There are different examples, but I think the main ones, for example, to protect infants against hepatitis B or respiratory syncytial virus, those are intramuscular administrations of the antibody. And often in the cancer setting where there's some antibodies that help treat certain cancers, those are likewise often subcutaneous or intramuscular. In a few cases, they might be intravenous, but as we discussed, the preferred setting is a much simpler, a subcutaneous type of administration.
Great. And a question actually had come in related. You had described, I think, particularly with VRC01 currently studied as an infusion, at least in adults, and a desire to move to an injection. What's the process both in terms of clinical development as well as manufacturing? I mean, what are the steps to go from an infusion to an injection?
Yes, it actually isn't all that difficult. It really involves just manufacturing at a concentration. So for a subcutaneous injection, of course, you want it to be a small volume, like a milliliter or two. So one has to make the antibody concentrated enough that we only have to give a small volume. And so actually we've done that for VRC01, and that's in phase one study. We've given it by subcutaneous injection. So it's quite feasible. One just has to build that into your clinical planning and manufacturing up front. And I would say that that's already being done with the next generation of antibodies.
Great. So actually, that's a perfect segue into this issue of next generation. So, I think people both in vaccine research over many, many years, as well as more recently with antibodies, have often said, by the time you get something that is manufactured into a clinical trial, the next discovery in preclinical phases may be even better. And you described even with VRC01 now the kind of next generation even of that same antibody. And how does that, as you look at this both as a scientist and researcher, but also in terms of product development, how does one need to think about clinical development and clinical studies with a product that may be, superseded by something that isn't yet ready for a clinical trial, but may look by similar preclinical studies to be more potent? And I wonder if you can kind of talk us through that thinking, especially given the work that you all are involved with right now.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what we need to think about. And I give a couple of examples. You asked about the industry interest. And so what we need here in the long run is not a laboratory to make the antibody, but a commercial entity, a pharmaceutical company. And so, again, what they need to see is some sense of clinical effectiveness, because at the end of the day, they do have a certain business model that's realistic for them to say that they are able to take on all of it that's involved to make a product at a large scale. So for antiretroviral drugs, of course, that model works. They can make them, then use them, and then the drugs also become available not just for treatment but for prevention. So we have to think along a similar paradigm. Another parallel to antiretroviral drugs is that in the early days we had one, AZT, which worked a little bit. I was an infectious disease doc when AZT first came on, and we all know that it wasn't very good by itself for preventing infections in babies. AZT by itself worked a little bit, but those data really provided the incentive for the field to say, well, if one works and we can get two or three, if you look at a timeline of discovery from AZT to the next drug, 3 or 4 years, to the next drug, 1 or 2 years, now 4 or 5 drugs, 6 months. And so the pipeline begins to fill in very quickly. So I think the way we're thinking it is one needs clinical data to say this type of strategy could work, and not only could it work, it could work in a way that's reasonable, manufacturable, cost-effective, and then that just really catalyzes the field, including industry, to come in and make these products available.
That's great, and you actually provide great segues into two additional questions that you just touched on there that came in. One, a number of times you talked about combinations, and a couple of different questions about both how would you choose to combine? Which ones would you combine? How do you actually combine them at an engineering level? And then thirdly, and I think this is coming from someone who works a lot on some other prevention research areas, multipurpose technologies, where we've heard regulators say we need people, we need to see if one thing works for HIV and then the other thing working, say, for contraception, and before they can be combined. And is there clarity about what the expectation is? Does each of the antibodies have to be demonstrated to work on their own before you can combine them? So kind of a three-part question about combinations. What do you want to combine? How do you do it? And what's the pathway?
Sure. We have a sense for what we want to combine by a lot of good laboratory data that says, you know, if you look just at two antibodies and test them against a large panel of HIV strains, they're actually very complementary. One antibody may miss 10 or 15% of the viruses. The other antibody may miss 10 or 15%, but they miss different viruses. So when you put them together and look at them, you just put them together in the test tube, you can see that they get close to 100%. So how do you move that forward? You need to make them individually and just show that they're safe clinically. Once they're safe clinically, one could either co-administer them as two separate agents in a person or co-formulate them, put them together in a vial and use them. So I think there is a pretty clear pathway on doing that. Again, all driven really by clinical data. The incentive to do that would come from the idea that, well, if one works and we know it works, then there's you can make a strong rationale from the manufacturing, the regulatory, the clinical perspective that we should now move forward for two because we have a strong scientific sense that it would work. And then, you know, with regard to other agents, it really, I think, depends on the indication one is looking for. If it's prevention, one can make the case, I think, solely based on a PrEP indication of how one might use an antibody, what dose, how long an interval, under what situations. It's a treatment indication. It would be different. And are we trying to reduce the viral reservoir in someone who is been suppressed for a long time? So I think the combinations really do depend in part on what we're thinking of using the antibody for.
So just to follow up on that, then the assumption then is that you may, one could imagine that there is a different combination antibody approach for prevention, maybe, than the one used for treatment, correct?
Yes, although I think it's also very possible that the same antibody or antibody combinations could work for both. But I think there would be some situations where you would tweak that. Once you get to the point of treatment, the fact that the antibody might actually kill infected cells, which is a different type of function that you might need for prevention, means you want to engineer that antibody to have a different Fc region, for example, that does different things. So I think as the field matures, you will see sort of side alterations of the antibodies to really help them optimize them for the specific indication.
Great. And I actually put up, for those still on the web interface, a slide that you showed earlier on. And when you talk about combining, and you mentioned that, I know you have another slide about how two together do better, but in terms of just looking at where these antibodies might bind within HIV, is the assumption that you would ideally have a cocktail that would look at antibodies looking at different regions here in this slide?
Yes, that is the scientific thinking, based on the fact that if the virus mutates one site, that the other site where the antibody, where a second antibody binds would then also have to be mutated in order for the virus to evade both antibodies. And that's not unlike, you know, combining a nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor and a protease inhibitor. The virus has to mutate two completely different genes, and here the virus has to mutate two different sites on the envelope. So the bar becomes quite a bit higher by strategically picking your sites, just as you said.
Great. Now, that's wonderful. And again, you had mentioned or alluded to something earlier about manufacturing, and someone asked a question that seems so basic, but I don't know if you can answer it. What's the current comparison of cost between, say, an antibody to be manufactured compared to an antiretroviral to be manufactured?
Yes. So that's a very important and, you know, a very fair question. The cost really is driven by two things. So how low a dose of the antibody can you use and how long will it last? So if we need to use an antibody at sort of the current infusions that we're using in the first study and the antibody lasts only a month, that will potentially be very expensive. But if we take one of the antibodies I showed you on the, in the laboratory that we have in hand at the laboratory, which is 10 or 50-fold more potent than the first generation, and that antibody actually would be effective for 3 months, and you do some basic calculations of what we call cost of goods, how much does it cost to make it, not what does somebody sell a drug for, but put it in a large manufacturing plant, and what's the cost of making it. The antibody becomes very similar to the current cost of antiretroviral drug prep, in theory. So the assumptions are antibody first has to work. Right? We know Truvada works. We don't know antibody works yet. But if it does, and if it works at a higher potency, or potency that we think is achievable, and it works for 3 months at a time, the cost now becomes very comparable to current antiretroviral drugs.
Great. And I'm going to open up the line just in a second or ask people if they want to ask questions. But I wonder if you could give us a sense, because some of these antibodies, as you say, are actually have been in human clinical trials, both for prevention and for therapy. And a fabulous question from someone saying, how have participants in the trials tolerated these antibodies, and are there any side effects that have been seen for any of these antibodies?
So generally, the antibodies have been very well tolerated. They've been given in many cases by intravenous infusion, but also now in many cases by subcutaneous injection. You see some local irritation at times that can be a little bit uncomfortable, but it's usually lasting a few minutes. And in general, there haven't been any what we call serious adverse events. On some occasions with the antibodies, since there really are many, many years of experience in giving antibodies to people, there can be some rare what we call systemic reactions, where someone may get a fever or some a rash or some other adverse event. So far, we haven't seen that, and generally we know that if we give human antibodies, such more serious adverse events are really quite uncommon.
Okay. Great. There are more questions here, but I think I'll pause. For those on the line, if anyone has a question and would like to ask it live, you can hit, I'm going to put that up so people can see it, you can hit *7 to unmute your line. I would ask that you introduce yourself, ask question briefly, and then *6 to mute yourself again to keep the line nice and clear. So I'll pause for just a minute to see if there are any questions from the line. Okay. I'll wait one more second. Anything? All right. Well, there is a couple more that had come in that I did want to get to. So that slide that you showed where there are a number of antibodies, different antibodies at similar sites in the virus. How translatable is data from one antibody to another, or is each quite a unique entity? And even as you were showing, I'll go back to your slide, two products that have had, I think, the most human clinical data, VRC01 and 3BNC117, both at that CD4 binding site. Is there anything one can say about, well, any antibody within that site does something similar, or is each antibody really its own entity and distinct?
I think within a site, Mitchell, the antibodies are likely to be very similar, but when we get to antibodies to a different site on the virus, it's possible that there are some differences. And what we think we know from laboratory and animal studies is that for the prevention standpoint, if the antibody binds the virus very potently, that's enough to block the viral entry into a cell, and so the antibody should work. So that's what we think we know. I think studies like the AMP study will tell us, what are we associating with protection? If there's clinical protection, is it the level in the blood? Is it the neutralizing function? This allows us then to bridge to other antibodies. So that's a key. That's why the clinical studies are so important scientifically. For treatment, it's also possible that binding on one part of the viral, for example, binding at the very top of the virus is different than binding at the base of the virus with regard to how well that antibody kills the cell. So there are some potential differences that will, I think, come out and be studied as more of these antibodies are available clinically.
Great. And actually, it's funny you should have just described some of the how important these clinical trials are. A question just came in from a great advocate asking, what is happening in terms of working with governments and other stakeholders where these trials are going to take place to understand both for policymakers as well as for potential participants in the trials to understand the implications of these studies, that some of these products may not be actually products as much as concepts that will inform the future, and how well is what's the process that's going on in that regard?
Yes, and this is very important because, you know, we spent almost an hour discussing a lot of these questions, so you can imagine that there's a lot of education that needs to go on. What, from my perspective, you know, as more of a laboratory scientist, what I see is that when we move to a study like what we call a phase two study or this AMP study, where we actually have to go through the formal process of writing a clinical protocol, going through IRBs, institutional review boards, going to the local communities where the study would be done, talking to people on community advisory boards, then you really formalize this process of articulating what you're trying to do, why are you doing this clinical study, what's the plan, what's the outcome of the study, and explaining it to people in lay terms. That really forces us to do what you said, which is to educate and explain and have a plan. And I think that's begun to happen in the context of this first 2B trial that will be started soon, and then it will be an ongoing process.
Great. And maybe, I know we're just getting to the top of the hour, but, you know, maybe, and I, because you've described it so well, both I think in the presentation itself, but also in other settings, if you could, you know, just on that last point, if you could describe a bit of your expectations or hopes and aspirations coming out of this first 2B trial in terms of, and again, you showed that, you know, the antibody can help us both as an antibody, but also to inform vaccine development. But I wonder if you could just help us all kind of understand what expectations we all might want to keep in our minds with a trial like that.
Sure. I try to look at it two ways, one realistically and one optimistically. So let me take the latter first. I think if a scientist isn't optimistic, you miss opportunities to make a real difference. Not everything we try is going to work, but unless we push the field and push the science, you may miss the opportunity to discover the next great drug, an integrase inhibitor, or to see whether an antibody works. The realistic parts of it are that a study like the AMP study will take a couple of years in time to enroll and even get the earliest data. And so we won't have in hand critical data for a couple of years to know whether we can then engender pharmaceutical companies, as you were asking, to really be interested and scale up. What would be the preferred sequence? We would like to see strong positive data of protection. You know, you could put a number on that, even if it's 60% or so. That's proof of concept. Industry becomes quite interested. It looks like it might be feasible. We begin to now have partners that are willing to make two drugs at a time at large scale or two antibodies, so that within several years, we actually have a product that would be highly effective potentially, that would be made to large scale and could be used. That's where we would ideally like to get to.
Great. John, that is so helpful. You know, it's a question I wouldn't dare ask you because it's one that I think every AIDS vaccine scientist and advocate and funder fears is, when might we have a product, a new approach? And I won't put you on the spot, but I think you're unless you would like to answer that, but your optimistic, realistic combination answer I think really does help frame this work going forward in terms of the collective thinking of the importance of both clinical trials but also the continued work in the laboratory and in earlier phases to create new and better and combine antibodies. So just remarkably helpful as we think about all of this. One piece, you know, and it just as we close, you know, at the Vaccine Research Center, you know, you are not just working on these antibodies and not just even on HIV. How does the VRC kind of, and how do you kind of see the portfolio and the balance in terms of vaccine candidates? And many of on the call will know that the VRC led the development of one of the vaccines that actually did go into a phase 2B trial several years ago. And what's the balance in terms of the portfolio there in terms of antibody-specific work and the more kind of classic vaccine approach?
Yeah, it's a fascinating question for us because I think we all appreciate how difficult the scientific challenges are for an HIV vaccine. I would say that remains our major focus and our major long-term goal. Antibodies have a shorter sort of potential to impact the field. So while over the past few years, I'd say our focus on antibodies has increased substantially, now it's a bit more balanced where, you know, we do both antibodies and vaccines in somewhat of an equal measure, but always with the eye towards the ultimate goal of developing a vaccine immunogen that could actually induce these antibodies.
Great. Really wonderfully helpful. I know we're now just past top of the hour, and I know various people, and perhaps you too, John, have to go. Any last thoughts before we wrap it up?
None for me, Mitchell. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to interested individuals on this topic. So thank you again.
Great. Well, we are most grateful. This is an area that I think for all of us is so important, as particularly as these larger clinical trials get underway. And I think what is really exciting is that 5 or 6 or 7 years ago, I don't think any of us would have thought of even having a conversation like this. We wouldn't have known what to talk about. And as you described, all of these new discoveries as quickly moving from early discovery into clinical development is a remarkably rapid pace, and one that we should really be celebrating and recognizing, not just on May 18th, as we get to 19 years and counting from President Clinton's first remarks about an AIDS vaccine to hopefully success on a number of fronts. So thank you so very, very much. I do want to remind everybody on the line that this call and materials will be uploaded shortly. And for those who might have missed it, just a couple of weeks ago, we did a call with investigators who presented at CROI around the dapivirine ring and results I know many of all on the line have been following and tracking. And then next week, next Thursday, March 24th, we'll be doing the next in the series, which is actually quite similar, I think, to the structure here. We're going to have two presentations related to long-acting injectable antiretrovirals that were presented at CROI. One, a study that was a trial looking at a prevention indication for one of the antibodies, and we'll have a sister presentation that was looking at the same antiretroviral in combination with another one for treatment. And so just as, John, you described the potential use of antibodies for both HIV prevention and treatment, the webinar next week, which actually begins at 10 a.m. Eastern, so this time exactly next week, as we're ending this one, we'll be starting that one, looking at long-acting injectables for both HIV prevention and for treatment. And as John described, we need all of these components in some larger combinations, hopefully, going forward. So hopefully the whole suite of calls really helps take us all forward. But, John, thank you so very, very much again for your time and patience in helping us all understand more and more about the importance of harnessing antibodies.
You're welcome, and thank you.
Great. Cheers, all.